Hey everyone, today's show is sponsored by PrettyRiot.com. PrettyRiot.com is a Houston-based blog that caters to music, art, fashion, and almost anything independent. Naturally drawn to the unbeaten path, Pretty Riot's goal is to shine some light on all the badass stuff you're looking for. We're in love with art and artists of all types, so we created a site as a platform to showcase these things to the world. You should definitely be reading PrettyRiot.com. Now, let's get down.
How did I get here? And now here is your host, Tommy Howdy.
All right. It's me, Johnny. I'm your host. Welcome to the show. Thank you for listening. There's been a lot of episodes, and I'll tell you, I went to, on Wednesday night, I went to Hotel Vegas here in Austin to play at the Bob Marley versus Bob Dylan thing, and I did a Bob Dylan song with Slow Train. You might remember Adoniram from a few episodes ago. Anyway, I got there and I went outside, and a couple of ladies were out there, and a lady came up to me and she said, "Are you Johnny?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "I love your podcast." And so we talked for a little while. She loved the Jeff Plankenhorn one the best. So she likes it when people are laughing on the show, which is good. I like it when people are laughing on the show, believe it or not. Anyway, I had a great time that night. My cousin Emily was there, and I did Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues. I might have just said that with Slow Train. It was a good time. It was a good show. My friend Graham Wilkinson put it on. He was on here as well. He was great. And I stopped in to see him play last night, but he wasn't there. So that was weird because he was supposed to play, but I guess he didn't. So that happened. Of course, he had played the night before, so maybe he was just tired, too tired to make it. I don't see him being like that, though. He's kind of a tough guy. Anyway, my guest today is a record producer here in Austin. He's amazing. He's worked with Burgess Meredith, White Denim, Crooks, What Made Milwaukee Famous, Shearwater, Susanna Schauffele, Aucherville River, Mr. Lewis and the Funeral Five, Dana Falconberry, Silent Diane, Tax the Boy Disaster, that's an interesting name, Golden Bear, and Frontier Brothers, Bright Light Social Hour, Spoon, tons of people. He's an amazing producer. His name's Danny Reich. He's also a drummer. He's been playing with Shearwater this year since their drummer, Thor, who's a very old friend of mine, is out on tour with Swans. I think it's Swans or The Swans. I'm not quite sure. Anyway, I've been talking to Danny a little bit over the last year, actually. I see him out every once in a while, and we end up talking. He's a really nice guy, and he came over today, and I just had a great time talking to him. And I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I enjoyed talking to him. And I guess without further ado, here's my new friend, Danny Reich.
I've had less than my fair share of lucky breaks and enough of this fooling around. I got one last chance to get rid of my past and bury it deep in the ground. And no matter what you try, man, you're never gonna tear me down when the only blame you cast is your own. And your only guarantee is your fear of the unknown. If you don't cut your losses before you get lost, they're never gonna leave.
So from the first episode of this show, your name gets dropped. Literally from episode one on.
All right.
And now you're finally here.
I'm finally here. It's
here.
A pleasure.
Danny Reich.
Hi there.
In my apartment that you can't really jam out too loud in. That's why I have a pocket pod lent to me by Paul English. So yeah, I mean, you are, you're an incredibly busy man.
I am.
And outside of all the production work that you do, you also play with Shearwater.
Right? I do, yeah.
And you just were on tour, told me the other night when I saw you.
Yeah. I've been on tour since the end of January and just got back maybe 10 days ago and got 2 months home. And then we go back out for a month with Dinosaur Jr., then back to Europe for a month in November. And that'll sort of wrap up all the touring for the most recent Shearwater record, which we've been... been out there playing and trying to promote.
Right. And did you produce that record as well?
I did, yeah. Yeah. And their drummer, Thor, has been playing with Swans for the last couple of years and has been sort of touring and busy with them, and just sort of came up where it was like, well, we've got this offer for this tour with Sharon Vedette, and who should play?
Yeah.
It's like, well, I guess I know all the songs.
Yeah.
It'd be an easy start.
Yeah.
All right, you want to do it? Sure. Okay. It was very easy. I mean, it's a 5-minute conversation. It's like, okay, I guess
that's very cool. It looks like you also play really great gigs. Like they looked, I saw pictures on your Twitter and stuff of shows and of the tour. It looked like they were nice theaters and a lot of people were there.
Yeah, yeah. It's been, most of them have been really good. I mean, obviously, you know, from touring, the you know, varies from night to night.
Yeah,
most definitely.
Yeah, I mean, you don't always put the empty room with the shitty in the corner pictures on Twitter.
Yeah, for every one of those, there's an empty dive bar in San Diego that there's 20 people at. So,
and so this week you've been working with Shearwater, or not with Shearwater? Sorry, with Slow Train.
Yeah, yeah. We just started their record on Monday, so 4 days ago. And we got through cutting the drums for most of their record, and I'm really excited about that one. And I just started the Black and White Years new record as well. So,
wow,
two very polar opposite in terms of style. The records are very different. One sort of organic and earthy and gritty, and which is Slow Train, and Black and White Years is a little more, it's a hybrid of more, you know, electronic and organic elements. And,
yeah.
It's a lot of fun. It's great for me to be able to bounce back and forth between two very different styles. It sort of keeps me really excited and engaged, but, you know, as opposed to just sitting and, you know, kind of doing like, well, this is my thing. I do these kinds of bands, and this is my drum sound, and this is my, you know.
Right, right.
It's nice to be challenged in new ways, and
I've noticed that the stuff that you do all has a different, it suits whatever band you're working with, which is pretty great.
Yeah, I try to, you know, I spend a lot of time in the practice space with bands before we go in to make the record, and we spend a lot of time listening to music and sort of talking about influences and, you know, records we both like, and, you know, stylistic references as well as sonic references, and usually, or at least hopefully, by the time we go in to actually track the record, everyone's totally on the same page on what we're going for, and we can kind of make something that's unique and special to, like, that is that record, that is really unique to that record and to that project, you know?
Right. And so the one that we heard at the very top is from the new What Made Milwaukee Famous album, which isn't out yet.
Yeah, no, that, yeah, it's...
You just got the masters.
Just got masters. It was mastered this past week. And yeah, I've actually not even heard the final mastered record, which I'm very excited about hearing, because we've been working on that one for a few years. That project sort of morphed from being a solo project for Michael Kincaid, their singer, to possibly going into this other direction with some of the other people he'd been collaborating with, and then kind of all came back into focus as a Milwaukee record by the end. So the 11 songs that appear on the record are, I think, you know, cohesive, but, you know, have been pared down from, you know, maybe 20 songs that we've tracked and recorded over the course of sort of going several different directions. And
right.
And yeah, I'm really excited to hear it all come together and mastered and kind of done.
Yeah. You know? And the first record that I really was aware of you was the Susanna one, when she first was on the first episode of this show. She had just finished it, and I guess she had gone and tried to make a record with some different people,
right,
and then finally came to you, and you seemed to capture, I mean, I'm using her as a reference only because that was the first time I heard of you. Also, I've spent a lot of music time with her, like playing tossing ideas back and forth and stuff like that. You really brought out like a great side of her, like with that record. Like, it's an exciting record. It's extremely different than the one that came before it.
Sure, yeah.
There's some grit in it, which I think really matches her voice. Was that purposely? Yeah. Were you trying to...
She's got so much character and her voice has got this like sort of smoky, edgy something to it, but it's also very classic. You know, it sounds, I mean, she also fits in sort of like 60s girl group sort of vocal style stuff too. So we were trying to, you know, reference everything from, you know, sort of 60s inspired, but then also some more kind of I don't know, edgy or contemporary or, you know, something with some grit and girth and kind of, I don't know how to describe it. I guess we listened to a lot of like St. Vincent and some of those kinds of records, which John Congleton did her last few records, and I think they do a really good job of.
Is that a guy from Dallas?
He's from Dallas, okay. Yeah. I
think do you know him? You're from Dallas.
Yeah. His band used to, they used to crash on my floor when they were coming down here to play.
And, really?
Yeah. So I've known him for a few years. And in fact, he did the last, not this most current one that I did, but the record before the last Shearwater record.
Okay.
So we're tied together, most definitely. But yeah, he did a great job on the St. Vincent records. And that's definitely was an influence. We listened to, you know, Nico Case and Feist, Broken Social Scene. I mean, we sort of were trying to identify some other female singers to do a good job of not being like balancing the pretty with something that's also maybe not aggressive, but just
gritty.
But gritty. Yeah, it's got some. You know, it's not too dolled up. It's pretty, but sort of. But yeah, got like some attitude and style.
Yeah,
and I think that really matches Susanna's personality and definitely her voice. And I'm really proud of that record. We worked on that for. That was another one that took, you know, over a year.
Yeah.
Put a lot of heart and soul into that one.
How is that? Because then you're working on those records. Say you're not going on tour with Shearwater, but you're working very on a record real slow, and then you're like finishing up another record, maybe starting another record,
right,
or in pre-production for a record. How do you compartmentalize your relationships, you know, with the band?
Yeah,
every single one is different, right?
It is.
And so when you're kind of almost juggling projects at some point. How is that?
It's tricky.
Do you ever get confused with songs and piss someone off and go like, "Oh, you know this song"? They're like, that's not my song.
I haven't done anything that egregious, but because I'm by the time we're actually working on the songs, I've listened to them so many times in the practice space. I'm pretty close to them, but I definitely have. I have to, you know, sort of be discreet in some ways and not. I try to not talk too much about what I'm doing with other projects because I don't want to influence the other people I'm working with in some way that, like, oh, well, we want to try that. And it's like, well, that was sort of something we did on that. It happened organically with that project. It didn't, I should put it this way. Musicians are all insecure.
Yeah.
We all are. I mean, it's a little bit scary to put yourself out there in the way that you do with your art. And they don't need any help. Wondering if what they're doing is as good or cool or second guessing or
right,
whatever it is. So I try to be kind of discreet with, I'll talk about the other records I'm doing while I'm working on a few projects concurrently, but you know, by having a little like patient client privilege.
I totally understand.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because in a lot of ways I do become a confidant for people. There's a lot of, I mean, we spend a lot of time together. We spend, I become very close with the people I'm working with, and there is sort of an element of being, I don't,
you almost know, not, familial.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. You sort of become, I feel like I become brothers, like with Susanna. I totally think of her like a sister, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And then there's always that thing, like when you work, on a record that's completely focused for a block amount of time, the separation, like, you know, the last few days of like working 6 weeks together, it's always such a weird kind of like everyone, the engineer, you know, the assistant guy, you know, everyone's just a little bit like, you know, sad.
Yeah.
Family's breaking up.
Totally. Yeah. Cause it does live within a certain, you know, at the end of the day or at the end of the project, like it does, like you do sort of go back to normal life or the band goes on to, you know, tour and promote and like play the songs 10,000 times until they're sick of them.
Right,
but yeah, there is a little bittersweetness when something finishes, because it is the end of sort of like some part of something that you kind of can't go back to, and you know, the creative process while you're in there working together, it's
right,
something really special that can and often does happen when you're putting so much of yourself and your creativity and your time and your thought into something, and then it's over and it sort of floats away and you go,
yeah,
well, there it goes.
Good luck, guys.
Yeah, I hope it.
I miss you.
Write me.
So
send me a postcard.
You started out playing. And it, I watched a video, and by default, you ended up the drummer because you couldn't have six guitar players in a band.
A little bit, yeah. You know, I was playing music with friends of mine when I was like 10 years old, and we wrote really hilariously awesomely bad songs. And
was that song 976 Dave? That's from your high school band?
That was actually a band I played in.
Oh, that was the name of a band.
That was, yeah, yeah.
That's a fucking great name.
Yeah, yeah, well.
976 Dave.
I think Dave Laubach would agree. It was...
so there was a Dave.
There was a Dave. It was... that was definitely a self-inflating, or, I don't know, maybe condemning band name.
Right. So you had an older brother? You have an older brother?
I do, yeah. I've got two brothers and two sisters. I come from a large family. My older brother and I played music together, and my little brother plays guitar as well. And we've just sort of always, there's always been music around us, I guess. My father's a photographer, and I think it's always just been sort of important in our family to find your creative, whatever it is that...
Voice.
Yeah, exactly. Find your voice and work really hard to become great at it. Both of my brothers are artists in their own fields.
What do they do?
My younger brother's a visual artist. He's a sculptor and lives in Prague.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
He went the whole way.
Oh, yeah.
He's like sculpting in Europe.
He is.
That's an artist.
And he's very good. I'm very proud of him. Yeah. And my older brother works for Pixar with his wife, Angelique.
That's fantastic.
So he does a lot. It's more digital, but it's still art. Yeah. Most definitely. Those Pixar movies are extremely well done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you started out on guitar,
mm-hmm.
And you had your first band at 10. Is that when you started playing drums?
Yeah, or? I didn't think of myself as a drummer until later. It was definitely drums by default because everyone sort of played guitar, and it was like, well, you can't have a band with six guitarists, so I was like, well, all right, I guess I just happened to be like just slightly better at drums naturally than everyone else. I mean, and by slightly, I mean like 1% maybe. Like I just got relegated to drumming duties after it was like, okay, well he's okay at it. Like he should sit over there. We've got enough guitar. So that's good for you. I mean, I still like playing guitar. I've lost so much of my ability because I just don't play as much as I used to, but I love playing guitar and piano and keyboards I would definitely say I went to music school and focused on drumming and recording and production. So
when you first got turned on to recording, you went to record at some dude's garage.
I did.
With 976 Dave, right?
I did. Yeah, I was 14, and we recorded in a quote-unquote studio, which was this guy in Denton's garage, and I think we paid him $300 to record our record, and, you know, it was like the drums went down to a mini disc, and, you know, very... You know,
I like a four-track mini disc.
Four-track mini disc.
So what year was like 96?
Yeah, probably so. Yeah,
so you're young. You're a pretty young guy.
Yeah.
You've done a lot of work for a young guy.
Well,
I mean, your discography takes up just the regular discography takes up two pages.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't counted. It's.
Well, in the font I chose, it did.
Yeah, Comic
Sans.
Like
old Victorian. Yeah. So you go and you record and it opens up this world to you. Like what? Tell me about that.
Well, you know, I'd always played when I was really young. We, my friend Chris Gruber and I, we had played music together. We'd write songs and have spend the nights and try to get his older brother, who we were both very, very, enamored with, cause he was, you know, 16 or 17, had a band. They actually played shows. We like totally looked up to him, and he had a four track and they would rehearse in their garage and we'd like spy on them and check it out, and it was totally inspiring and awesome to watch. But we'd get his older brother Jeff to record us, you know, whatever song we'd written the night before while we were hanging out. And eventually, I think it just became, well, there's the four track. You know, this is how the tapes work. You guys can sort of do this yourself. And that was really cool, but it never felt like something substantial. And we went in and recorded this album in Denton that you were just talking about. Looking back, it was such a small thing, probably for the guy that worked on it, and really in the big picture, wasn't that big of a project or that much time spent, but it really did change.
It's like the straw that broke the
camel's back or something. It really made me go like, wow, like look at what you can do with recording music. Like you can create so much this way. It sounds so clear. We can do anything with this. And it just sort of blew my mind. And after that, I guess I just sort of, other than just playing drums, I became kind of fixated on the possibilities of like what I could do with recording and started playing with my own four track and, you know, working on.
Was it a digital four track?
No, this was cassette. These are all cassettes.
Old school.
Old cassettes. Yeah. I don't, the having like the mini disc four track was like a big deal for us. We're like, whoa, it's digital. It sounds so, like there's no hiss. It just, the music starts. It's amazing. Yeah. You know, you can't hear it when you hit play and
yeah.
You know. So by the time we'd finish a song, we'd had bounced, you know, these four tracks down over and over and over. And you know, it's like the drums are on one track, then you throw your tambourine on the same one, and then the bass goes there. And by the time it's over, there's, you know, it's pretty much just sounds like TV snow, and there's like a little bit of a tambourine or whatever you put last. So it was amazing to go make this recording with my friend Dave and just sort of like have my mind blown about what you could do with layering and arranging. And it sort of changed my focus from just, you know, kind of playing music and having fun doing it to going like, I really want to do this like all the time. Like, this is the most fun I ever have.
Right.
And I need to find out how to do this nonstop.
Yeah. It's almost like when you discover masturbation.
Yeah.
Like the next
kiss
big,
the rest of your free time goodbye. Ooh, like, that's it.
Yeah. I'm just going to be doing this.
Yeah.
So you got an internship shortly after, or like
did.
A year after or something?
Yeah, I started interning.
You were just trying to like take it in any way you could.
Totally. Yeah, I was just trying to like absorb it. I mean, I had absolutely no idea how this was actually done. None. I just made little EPs and cassettes over the weekend that we'd sell to our friends for $1 so we could buy more tapes to make more recordings, you know.
Right.
That was absolutely the limit of my experience with recording. And I got to work in assisting and interning in a studio when I was, I guess I would have been 16 or 17 at that point, and started really spending all my free time there, working at a studio called Summit Burnett, which is in Dallas, and was sort of a big, very popular studio in the 70s. It had echo chambers, tape machines, like
you could fit
in, you know, 80 person orchestra in the studio. So, really big sort of classic old school studio, the kind of place that doesn't really exist that much anymore with a few exceptions on the East Coast, West Coast. But it was really good for me to get to learn, like go from kind of messing around with my four track to go like, this is how it is really done. Like on an actual tape machine, like this is how you calibrate it. This is how you clean the heads. This is, you know, you sit there by the tape, wait for the tape to, you know, you rewind it. Like this is, it was really cool to see like actual real bands come in and play and hear.
What kind of bands were they? Were they big money bands or what, like label bands or?
Yeah, some of them.
Bands.
Yeah, some of them. I mean, they're all. If they were working in that studio, they obviously had enough money they were substantial in some way. I mean, It wasn't like jingles or anything like that. It was actual records being made in there. I would say at that point, I would guess that really all those bands were on labels, and when that was a lot more viable and feasible, and people were still sort of buying records, there were a lot more labels. And
how did you navigate that socially? Because you were obviously a lot younger.
Yeah, it was weird
experience. Did you just were you a guy that was smart and didn't say anything?
Kinda, yeah. Until they're like, "Hey, you want a beer?" And I was like, "Yeah." And then the engineer would be like, "You know, catch me," and I'd obviously get in trouble. It was weird because I tried to stay out of the way and just read and read and read and watch just what, you know, it's not really your place to sort of interact at that point yet, you know, and I learned that quickly that what I need to do is just sit and learn and watch how they do this.
I'd around the same age, my mom dated a guy that owned a studio as well, and I was kind of given you just come and hang out whenever you want, you know.
Yeah.
I was 16, I did the same, but I remember that feeling of being like, well, here's the Fabulous Thunderbirds, but I certainly can't just like,
yeah, you can't go and say, hey, what's up,
hey,
guys?
Can I have a cigarette?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's just too weird. Hey, Jimmy Vaughn, what?
Can I borrow your shades?
I was gonna go for a walk.
Yeah. Yeah, but
there was just, I remember this sort of like, you were learning, were you like, I'm lucky to be in this position.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm just gonna fucking not say anything wrong.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. Until, you know, you get an opportunity like the engineer's late and you're the one there, and it's, you know, right, everyone's looking right at you and like, yeah, hey, what are we doing? And yeah, I was like, well, I mean, I didn't have some legendary story. It was like, yeah, the engineer didn't show up, so like, I'm recording Fleetwood Mac Rumors. Like, that didn't happen. But, you know, I got to, I did get some opportunity to like actually sort of run the show a little bit. And boy, that was eye-opening, because it's one thing to watch, and you know this from anything, music or anything creative, it's one thing to watch or observe and
yeah,
and see how it works. It's a whole other thing to be running the show.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, so by the time I went to music school to continue to learn about it, it was like I'd already been working in a studio for a few years and worked on a bunch of records and assisted and sort of seen the process and learned it from guys that were sort of firmly rooted in doing it kind of the old school way, that had come up in the studio that was, you know, like James Brown and the Rolling Stones had worked there in the 70s. It was that kind of studio.
Yeah, and you mean like performances, like, you know, you got to be able to do it.
Yeah, you got to be able to play. I mean, we were working on tape, and it just, you know, it was. I'm really lucky that the studio that I ended up sort of learning a lot of this from happened to be a place that was sort of firmly rooted in doing it the old school way, the
right,
sort of classic way, focusing on musicians and performance and getting it right to tape and sort of learning how it was done. And I think that's really good. And I still carry a lot of those production techniques, even just the type of sounds that I first heard that like were first sort of like first floored me. I think I still, I reference that kind of chamber reverbs and spring reverbs and you know, those kinds of sounds were really huge when I heard like the tidal wave of reverb coming back from echo chambers. It's like, well, that sounds better than that reverb preset on my little console. There's
lexicon,
something to this. Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. And I still carry a lot of those, try to carry some of that aesthetic and those techniques with me today.
Speaking of that aesthetic, you came in at, what was the end of analog?
Essentially,
like the end of tape.
Yeah, yeah, you know? Exactly. And the end of the studio industry in a way that it had existed for a long time.
Yeah,
I mean, the guys I was working for had staff engineering jobs. They had health insurance or salaries. Yeah. You know, that.
By the time you got out of college, what was it like 2001? You're like, what the fuck?
Yeah, I mean, it's like that doesn't this? Exist. Yeah, exactly. This? So yeah,
so,
I mean,
so let me ask you this real quickly: is the aesthetic of tape versus digital? I interviewed Mike McCarthy last week, and we had a long talk about it. But I think that it was all at the top, and it was all so intensely scientific that I just skipped the beginning of it because it was a little, I thought it might be a little much for the listeners, but where do you stand on it? Like, what's your, like?
I like them both. I think they're both good. I think they both, I think I need them both. Yeah.
Do you use them both?
Yeah.
Like you work on both mediums?
Yeah, I work on, you know.
You have a tape machine?
Sure. Yeah. 2-inch machine, a 3M M79, 16 track. Yeah, I mean,
that's the fattest man.
It is. It sounds really good.
Sorry, go ahead.
Hey, that's the fattest man.
That's the fattest man.
Yeah, I think, you know, the workflow can be inhibiting. It's a slower session. It sounds really good, and if a band wants to make a certain kind of record, you need that. And it's just a tool. It's a color that can change the way you work and listen, and it certainly changes the workflow for making the record if you're going to work on tape.
Yeah,
as opposed to working in digital.
What about the tape itself? Like Mike was saying, when I was talking to him, he was like, "Oh, I went and bought, like, you know, I had $5,000 in savings, and I just took that and bought tape."
Yeah, yeah.
Because the place was closing down. Is it over?
Yeah.
Is
there There's tape being made. There's a factory that sort of reopened, and there is tape being made, and a lot of people will use what's called one pass tape. It's like archival tape. It's been used to,
right,
you know, back up masters of, you know, some film score or something like that, and, you know, has since been sold because it's been digitized, and it's been used once and stored in a humidity and temperature controlled warehouse, and you can get it for, you know, fairly cheap, $75 a reel.
That's really cheap.
Yeah.
So you actually do recording that uses both mediums?
Yeah, I usually work on both. Most records I work on start on tape and get transferred to digital, and then we finish it and mix it digitally. And it's not to say that we mix it like in the computer. It'll come back out into the analog world by out into a console where we mix. But
right.
But yeah, I typically start on I typically start by tracking drums and bass to tape. They sound really good. The low end has a lot to benefit from, sort of the heft that thickness that the tape can. It can kind of glue everything together in a way. It's just a sound. It's a slower way to work. It's, you know, you don't think about this, but even just like sitting and waiting for the tape to rewind.
Yeah.
It's like, I actually got to interview an engineer yesterday that, I really look up to. And he was sort of talking about, one of the things that he notices is just in terms of communication now with sessions with digital, there's, you know, you just sort of run a take. And you could get in this loop where you're not like stopping to talk about anything. And that time that you get while the tapes are winding was an opportunity to go like, well, what's working here? Like everyone's sort of engaged and talking there's a lot of things you sort of intangible things. It has nothing to do with the tape, but it's just because you're sitting and waiting for it to wind, like maybe you're more engaged and talking about it and not just on your iPhone while, you know, 30 takes fly by and he'll comp it together and, you know, cut it all up. And I don't know. I think there's something to that. I think you listen differently when you don't have something to look at, and there is a benefit to that. I mean, some of the best things about tape to me have nothing really to do with just strictly the sound of it. It's just you work differently in a way that there's a little more communication and you're using your ears and not your eyes.
Right. Right. So you interned at the studio and then you went to school where, San Marcos?
Yeah, I went to school at Texas State, which was Southwest Texas at the time. And I started working for a sound design company while I was in school doing, sample libraries and stuff like that, programming keyboards and drum machines for Akai and Insonic and Korg. And that was sort of my first, I guess, professional gig. And I did that for a few years and started working in a studio in San Antonio for a couple of years while I was living in San Marcos and playing in the Lemurs here in Austin and driving down to San Antonio for work. And a hectic few years there. I was sort of all over trying to make it all work and trying to play and get the Lemurs off the ground and tour and finish school and working, you know, to stay alive. So I definitely would not want to go back to those few years. It was like, I spent so much time in the car up and down I-35, but you know, I learned a lot. The Lemurs, we ended up playing a lot of really awesome shows and writing a lot of music.
Had a good run.
Yeah. I'm very, very proud of it. And, you know, the work I did when I was going to school and having to work, you know, sort of full time at this studio, it's really good. I mean, I learned a work ethic that it's really important. It's something I still carry.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, a lot of people, they don't get trained to work as hard as they can, as long as they can, you know what I mean? And a lot of working in the studio is there's all the beautiful artistic and inspirational moments, but really, how long can you do it? Because a lot of times it takes a very steady hand. You know?
and a lot of patience to be able to go like, okay, we're making a very small but important gain on the overall project today, and going like, well, we're 1% better. The record is better. We're 1% closer to finishing, and like that's okay for today. And it takes some patience to get through it. I mean, one thing I will say is that I don't see out of a lot of younger guys that are into recording is that if you haven't been in sort of like a professional working environment, in particular like this one in San Antonio, we had like, you know, I mean, it wasn't just music; it was ad agencies and all kinds of stuff, but.
Like zero fail missions.
Yeah, like there is
something's at stake.
Yeah, something is always at stake.
And you can't blow it off.
Yeah, you can't just come in hungover and like, you know, just sort of, I mean, I did, but you can't just come in and sort of blow it off. It's not just like, everyone's hanging out and it's cool, man. It's like, it was like, you show up for work at this time, the session starts in, and I'm like, you need to be working fast and it needs to be really good.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of pressure on it. Yeah, they're paying and they pay now, and they pay other people that don't have that work ethic. But I think that if you've been in that sort of work environment, it does something to the way you look at your work and treat it like professionally.
Totally.
And not.
Well, that's interesting. Like where do kids now? Where do they intern? What do they do?
I don't know. I mean, I've got some interns myself, and I try to. I try to relay that sort of type of professionalism to them, you know, so that they understand, like, and not in a way where I'm like, I'm not writing them super hard and, you know, I'm not a dictator or anything, but.
But you're also not standing for a bunch of bullshit.
No, yeah, exactly. Like, if something's not right, then I'm telling them.
At a certain level,
yeah,
and that is, you know, but so your clients have a certain experience when they come in,
absolutely,
and never go below this.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. I don't want them like sort of like hanging out, and it's just like sort of a party, and we're all just chilling. I mean, I want it to be comfortable, but I want it to also be professional, and them to feel like they've gotten their money's worth for what they've paid, and that I've put the time in. You know, outside of the session, to be mentally prepared and you know, the place is clean and sort of, it feels like a professional environment within a sort of more comfortable context is sort of the way I run my studio. I think it's important.
I worked with Jack Joseph Puig. He mixed a record I did, and I got to go and for like 6 weeks every day.
Going,
you know, it was kind of a disastrous situation. Why it was like that was because our shit had to be approved, but it was before T1 lines, like it was in 1999.
Yeah.
And so we had to physically put a disc on a plane of a mix and send it to the dude, and then that dude would call us that night and tell us what to do the next morning. And so it was like, if he didn't approve it the next day, there was just a whole other day of time loss. Anyway.
He's one of the like most legendary gear nerds.
Oh my god!
Ever in like in the world, his studio's absurd.
It's hilarious. Prototypes too. Like he's got everybody's. You know, everybody gives him their shit to see, and it's all like, oh, this is a you know.
We'll see if it stands up to Jack Joseph.
Yeah. And so, but what I was going to say was the aesthetic. Like, I don't know if you've seen photos of his place. It's all decked out. It's a very Indian looking thing, and he was very into that. Like there was a. I remember one time he got bent out of shape about one of the runners didn't get the sauce right or the dressing right on salad. And I was like, why are you getting on that dude? Like, fuck.
Yeah.
Salad dressing. He's like, that's where it starts. You fuck up the salad dressing. What else are you fucking up?
That's it, yeah.
And I was just like, wow, you're right. And so his thing was like that. He was like, you couldn't come in until he had the place lit right.
Yeah, right.
You know,
right.
And you'd walk in and he's got his like velvet coat on.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like these weird kind of like pirate shirts and shit. Like
that's exactly how I see him in my mind. It's like, velvet coat with
weird,
a pirate shirt.
Yeah, it's crazy Spaniard. Anyway, I mean, that to me, I'll never forget that experience.
Yeah.
And no one to me ever made such a big deal about showing up to work, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I think what it comes down to is, like, taking pride in what you do. And even, you know, even, like, that story about, you know, messing up the salad dressing, it's like, you're right, it's not a big deal, but when you take pride in making sure that everything you do is extremely good, and you don't put your name on it unless it is, and, or, I mean, really, you keep working until it is, I guess is what I should say. But, yeah, I mean, that's... If you don't have pride in it, then what's the point? I guess you know, it's like why are you doing this? You don't care about it. It's just this throwaway thing. You're like, oh yeah, I'm just trying to stay busy and make a little money recording some bands. Like who cares? Almost anyone can do that.
Yeah,
that's not that big a deal. Putting a lot of time and thought and into becoming great at it and working and pushing yourself and dedicating your life to it—that's a whole other thing.
Right. Yeah. What's the recording guy at Texas State?
There's a few down there. Bobby Arnold was the guy that ran it for many years. I think
there was a guy that I went to school. You know Chris Pear, the sound girl.
Yeah,
we were in school together.
Oh, Mark
in like
Erickson.
The late 80s. Mark Erickson.
Right. Yeah. I remember her telling me that was like one of her first teachers. I guess. In Houston.
Mine too.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
It's funny. Yeah, I actually emailed Mark yesterday. Those guys have been have made such a huge impact on me as well. I guess I feel like all these. It's funny going back and thinking about all these little experiences and going, God, so many people have been part of what has, like, over many years sort of shaped what my focus is and what my the way I sort of view really all of this music and, you know, my profession. And wow, it's crazy. Yeah, so many little things like going and recording in this little place in Denton, some guy's garage, and when I was, you know, 14 years old and had to get a ride to the studio because I couldn't drive. It was like this. It was just some weekend. I'm sure that guy would never even remember being in there with me, but
you walked out a different
people,
person.
Yeah, all these people, and it's it's kind of nostalgic and good to look back on it. Sometimes you get so caught up working and looking forward to whatever the next thing is. You don't really stop to like turn around and go, whoa,
yeah,
I've done a bunch of stuff. That's really good. Or look at all these places I've been. That's cool.
You really have. So you graduated from college. What did you do afterwards? Were you still working in the studio in San Antonio?
Yeah, I was. I mean, really what I was doing at that point is I was touring a bunch with the Lemurs and had sort of put off finishing college and it, in some ways sort of compromised like being able to keep that job in San Antonio. It was such a full-time thing. I mean, it was really hard to be able to leave for 4 weeks and come back and expect to get time scheduled. So when we started touring more, and I also became very aware of the fact that it wasn't, while it was really good for me to work in that sort of like extremely almost too professional sort of environment, like where it's almost sort of like it's a little bit nerdy, you know, like stuff we were working on. I realized, you know, over the course of like touring with the Lemurs that really what I need to do is be for sure based in Austin instead of kind of living in Austin and then traveling over for work and taking stuff. I needed to sort of like settle down and begin, you know, or look for the next thing here in town. Cause I was sort of living here, but also like just up and down I-35 nonstop for work and for school and for, and you know, it's just exhausting. And, so I moved here and started working a lot at Cacophony Recorders, which is Eric Wofford's studio.
Right.
And
he's a guy that does another great load of lots really of stuff. Great work.
Totally. Yeah, he's great. I mean, and Eric as well has had a huge influence on the way I, you know, I feel like I've cherry-picked little bits from all of these places and experiences that have somehow shaped it. And Eric is certainly part of that. And in particular, working at his studio, it's a big one-room studio. You're in the same room as the musicians. And,
right.
That's sort of how I run my place. I like that a lot. It creates this like, there's a lot of energy and you can feel when the take is really good. You're sort of right there next to everybody. Yeah. You can see it and hear it and you're sort of immersed in it in a way that you could sort of disconnect when you're in a traditional studio environment where you're in the control room and the musicians are out in the studio and it's double pane glass between you. And it's like, it's easier to check out when you're not like right there engrossed in it.
Right. And then there's always that horrible psych out that happens when you're the guy out there like singing the vocal and then the take stops and then you just see the guy look at the other guy and go, making exactly. These faces like, oh, you're like, what?
Like they're
what?
Talking shit about me right now.
Yeah,
exactly.
So that's a good environment. You started working at Cacophony. You worked on a lot of records there.
I worked on a bunch. Yeah, I still track stuff over there. I still track like that Crooks record that just came out of this past summer, spring.
Oh yeah, that's
I did,
right.
You I did that one over there. Yeah. I work a lot over there and a bunch of different studios around town. I mean, just whatever fits for the project and whatever's appropriate in terms of like the type of studio and type of sounds I can get out of studio and whatever the band's going for and the sort of aesthetic that we've kind of defined as like being like what we're going for on this record. And, you know, that sort of dictates where I work, but, I've done a lot of work at Cacophony and I love being over there.
And so your place is more of like doing the overdubs, and do you do a lot of mixing there?
I typically mix out at this little private studio in Westlake that a friend of mine has kind of slowly built up over the last 5 or 6 years, and it just depends. I don't really. My place isn't just an overdub place. It's it's also not where I typically do everything start to finish, but it's hard to say. Every project's different. I mean, I've done records start to finish there and they've turned out great. And I've, you know, sometimes all we do is overdubs. Sometimes I do the basic tracking and mix somewhere else. It just sort of depends on the sound and what we're going for.
Right. One thing I've noticed is that you work with a lot of bands. There aren't like a lot of single named, just name people.
Well, you know what? Even though there's a band name, there's often one guy. There's one or two guys generally. And you know, like Shearwater is, it's similar to that. You know, Jonathan Myberg, the singer of the band, songwriter, he and I did that record sort of together. We did a week of tracking with Thor and Kim, their bassist and drummer. And then we sort of spent months, just he and I kind of working, doing it together, really just the two of us, and had a few people come in and help, you know, just on some of the like accent stuff. But I mean, even though there's bands, a lot of times it is me and like mostly one guy working, and we do some tracking with everybody, and just everyone's there and involved. But, I think I tend to prefer to work with like one person at a time, or I guess I shouldn't say one person at a time, because I like having the band there, but I like having someone there with me to sort of like kind of guide it, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, but every band is different. I mean, some bands there's the rock and roll democracy that they are attempting to, you know, abide by, which is always difficult and funny to watch, and it can be very trying because everyone's trying to accommodate everybody, and it's like five people all with five ideas and want to take it five different ways, and sometimes the compromise between two valid good ideas is something that totally doesn't make any sense, and it's, you know, that can happen. But you know, on the other hand, there's a lot of those bands where it is one guy or visionary, maybe a pair of guys that really like they're writing it. They have like they do have a vision for it, and it's them that I'm working really closely with throughout the entire process to make sure that we're on the same page and you know, creating hopefully what it is they hear in their head, and or you know, even something even better, something they couldn't even have imagined. And you know, if we've done that, then I've done an all right job.
Yeah, you were talking also about going last night with the guys from Slow Train, and having a little you know, having a little blow off some steam time with just the band, and after you've worked that hard, it's nice to go out and kind of celebrate your
We, you know, we spent 4 days of, you know, working, you know, 12 hours, 10 hours, whatever it was, and got a lot of work done. We started the record on Monday and got this huge first phase of the process done. And, it's always, it's good to get out and kind of hang out with everyone and go, man, that was a lot of work. Let's hang out, but not talk about that stuff. Let's just hang out.
Let's talk about chicks. That's what Jack Joseph Prigg used to say when we'd sit down to dinner. He'd be like, I'd say something like, oh, tell me about jellyfish this. And he'd be like, no. Let's talk about chicks.
God, he is such a bizarre cartoon.
I know. That's awesome. He totally is. And the people that know him totally just are constantly making fun of him for it. Yeah. For his thing. Oh,
he's got to
know it. I mean?
I mean, he's got to
know. Totally. Like, he knows. Like, he's like, you know, he's like a guy like, I got this jacket yesterday. It'll blow your fucking mind. Like, seriously? Yeah, I'm going to wear it to the Grammys. No one else will fucking have it. I swear to God. These are like, he's all proud and like,
oh my God,
like a rooster. Anyway, so
crushed velvet.
Yeah, crushed velvet. I don't know if he still does that. That was 1999. I can't imagine he's still like pirate.
It's funny that you say the pirate shirt and crushed velvet. That really is exactly how I.
Well, he would like sometimes have ruffles coming.
Yeah, ruffles like, out of the. Yeah.
There were a couple of guys in my band that were like, I can't even talk to the fucking guy just because it's so ridiculous.
That's great.
Yeah. That's great. Anyway, so. So what are you working on now? You're working on Slow Train, and you said you were about to start.
Yeah, Slow Train and the Black and White Years. I'm doing their new record. We just finished their first, what I think maybe their first single. There's other, you know, contenders for that title. Hopefully, ones I didn't even pick out as being singles could, you know, become that. You never know. But we finished their first song last week, and then I started on Slow Train this week. And what else? I just finished Tax the Boy Disaster's record, and I'm a giant fan of those dudes. I've loved their music for, I just think they're awesome.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited about that. And like you mentioned earlier, that What Made Milwaukee Famous record is finally going to see the light of day after many years of hard work and, you know, sort of shifting the, I guess, project's goal. It's sort of congealed into one thing and is actually done.
Yeah.
So that's a very good feeling. But yeah, I'm really excited. Who else? I'm working with JC & Co, which is Jason Cronus. I used to play in Bel Air with, and he used to play bass for Boxtrot and The Black and a few other bands around town. I'm also a giant fan of him as a dude and of his songwriting. So I'm very excited about that one as well.
Do you get to go out and see a lot of music? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I've seen you out a few times. That's how we met.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's nice to go out. It's really nice to go out and see stuff I'm not working on. I mean, it's cool to go see the bands I'm working with perform, but it's sort of better to those nights you go out and you're like, yeah, I've never heard of these bands, and someone just totally blows your mind. Like, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And, there's nothing quite like that, you know, when you go out and someone just totally blows you away and you weren't expecting it. And I mean, that's how I meet a lot of people, is just going to shows.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean,
you gotta be out there doing it.
Yeah, I mean, and I enjoy it. It's not, it doesn't feel like that's not work. That's right. That's fun to go hang out and see music.
And people are happy to see you.
Yeah, you know, it's good to.
It's a good feeling.
I do work a lot, so it's sometimes it's hard to get out and actually make time to hang out with people, and so it is good when you go out and actually get to hang and see some people. Yeah.
So real quick before we get too far from this, you were just talking about the Black and White Years and singles and stuff like that. How tied are you to what happens after the record leaves you?
Yeah.
Like, do you watch them? Do you obviously talk to them? Hey, how's the record going? Or,
You know, it depends. I think it depends on the project and the type of record it is. But, I mean, that involvement can vary from, man, I'm really glad this is done, like, sort of good luck, you know, if it didn't go that well. Up to, like, with Shearwater, like, I've played 120 shows with them this year since the record came out.
Right.
So,
well, more of that, I mean, like, I know, I mean, even on, like, a small level, I know John Ailey, you know, make a call and see if you can get on Eclectic.
Oh, sure, sure.
Like, this kind of thing. How do you...
Of course.
Obviously, the selling of music and the distribution of music has completely changed, and it is in a state of flux where people aren't really selling this music that people are making. There's a lot of stuff being given away, a lot of stuff being passed around.
Right, right, right.
And how are you affected by that in any way?
Of course.
Do you fear it, or is there a certain thing you like, or?
I think I just
accept, just going with it.
Yeah, I don't think fearing it or being mad or whatever is actually going to do anything for me. So I've sort of just accepted that's how it is. And but yeah, I mean, and to answer your question about promoting the music or the record, whatever it is, after I've finished it, I put so much of myself in it. I've got a lot personally invested in every single record I do. I've spent so much time and thought. And put a lot of try to put as much creativity as I can into each one. And, you know, when it comes out, I want every single one of them to be successful. So if I can help in any way, I try to, I always try to. I mean, that I can't send every single record I do to every single record label I've worked with and every promoter, you know, it's about sending the right ones to the right people that are, you know, and sort of valuing those relationships I've got with those people and not sort of abusing it too.
Right. Exactly.
But yeah, I always try to, and I hope it helps. I mean, generally, I there's maybe someone I know that I overhear the band's talking about something, or you know, I've got some way I might be able to help them. Then I'm gonna do it.
That's good. Yeah. That's good. I just didn't know. I didn't know, like, if you're making a record at this point, like, you know, some people put out records and they still get really disappointed. Like, oh, no one. We only sold like 40 CDs at a record release. And it's like, in a world where there's no record stores anymore, like, that's pretty good. I mean, in my eyes, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it definitely changes. I mean, the way it affects me is like, well, if you're only going to sell 40 CDs for $10 a piece, then you're going to make $400. It affects, when you look at what you're actually going to make off of it, it's like bands have to make a value call on how much you're going to spend on it. Yeah. And that does affect me because it's, you know, it affects how much time I have with them to create something that there's less time than ever.
Right.
I mean, I wish I could, I guess when I said I'm accepting of the current state of the music industry, it's like, there's still part of me that, I wish it could be 1975 and I had a million dollar record
budget.
Like
bring back the establishment.
Yeah. But, but you know, you know, that system was broken and was flawed for many years, and that's why the music business is sort of paying for it now, and it's in the state that we're in. And
but you're okay with it. You're not. It doesn't inform your. You're still out there working. You're
You know. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't. I have to be really careful, and I have to make the most of every single day because I don't get as much time ever as I would like. I'd always wish I could have more time on what I'm working on. no matter how much time I have, I could always use more, you know. Right. But
it's also probably why you have to spend, I mean, not that people, you shouldn't spend time in pre-production, because really that's just the, you have to, but you have to now.
Like, you don't have much
choice.
I don't have any
choice. You got to go in there. You got to make sure everybody, every drum fill is there. You can't question anything when you're laying this shit down, because you lose time.
It's no time. It's, you know, like you know, I was talking about this slow train stuff. We tracked the basics for the record in 4 days. And
that's still a long time, really, to think about. And in this time, you know, to go into a studio.
Maybe so. Yeah, it seems short to me, but it's also sort of like it's possible to do it. It's about as short as you can possibly do it. Yeah. In my mind, I mean, maybe you can do it less, but not if you're gonna like really spend time making sure every single one is right. But yeah, it's true. It's you have to have so many details worked out in advance. That's why I spent so much time with the bands beforehand, talking about the arrangement and what's going on, getting all the tempos mapped out, working on the structures, like getting every bit there, because there's not time once we're in there to, I mean, I wish there was, but there's just not, you know, I don't have 6 weeks just to cut drums on something, you know. Right. It's like we can't just write in the studio. We have to sort of commit to stuff, and the studio has to be sort of, at least in part, I mean, I want it to be fun and creative and try to always make it that way, but it also has to be focused, and you know, you have to work to make sure that it's you're getting the most out of every single day, because there's just not enough.
Yeah, there's not enough time.
Yeah.
So serious there. I don't really know what to.
It got real. We're getting real, man.
Real, man. Well, do you mix records? I saw also there was a whole other thing. You do a lot of you've done a lot of music for movies and sound for movies.
Yeah.
Is that?
I don't do as much of that anymore. I did for many years do a lot of like post-production and scoring and doing music for films. And it's tough, because that world, you have to sort of, you kind of have to be all in that in order to
be in it,
to maintain and stay working and busy. It's tough to like leave and go on tour and then come back and be like, hey, where's all the, and they're like, oh, we got this other guy who's doing it. You know, it's no different than music, and then like you sort of have to be all in it and to be doing it all the time. I'd love to have a little bit more time to do that type of project, because it is fun to get out of the usual workflow of pre-production and rehearsals, and bands come in and we're working on like creating their songs and building their music. It would be fun to like get to do it for like watching this thing on the screen and get it. It's just good to shift gears. I think anytime you get sort of too inside your own head, or you kind of keep doing the same, to find yourself doing the same things over and over and over, it's time to switch gears and do a different type of project, challenge yourself in some way. And,
keep yourself.
Yeah, it keeps you interested and engaged and feeling good about what you're doing, instead of just going like, oh, this is just this job, this band's coming out. I got to do the same thing I always do. You know, I don't ever have that feeling, because I'm always, I mean, every single day I'm doing something different.
Right. And there's also a lot of live stuff you've recorded.
Yeah, I don't do as much of that anymore. I've really been focused on like producing records.
Right.
But I still, in the last few years, I do all the recording for Fun Fest for Transmission, and that's always, it is fun. It's a lot of pressure. There's no chance to fix it if you mess that up. So, but I do enjoy it. I mean, it's cool mixing live stuff and seeing it.
Put out records, or they put out thing, or they're just recording it for posterity eventually?
Yeah, for posterity, and then they they'll release videos of the bands playing, and like last year I did four songs with for Vice, ended up releasing some of their live performances from the festival, and we worked on that and mixed that, and it's you know, it's fun. It's a total different type of thing than like creating a song. But it's good. It makes you know, makes me better at mixing records, because I've learned how to deal with adversity, you know, mixing
like that.
Mixing vocals when there's monitors blaring right through it. And
do you mix like straight up mix records? Do people send you records to mix?
Yeah, they do. That's been happening more lately. I think it's partially because more people are doing the records on their own, and they want someone to go like, you know, like, I don't know what to do with this. Clean it up. Fix this. Please
fix
help me get the ball across the finish line.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's fun to do. It can be likewise. That's a that's a challenge that sometimes you get handed some tracks that are,
yeah,
you know, like from point A to where they would like it to go.
Right, like,
well, maybe we need to reconsider where, you know, this isn't going to become, you know, whatever it is that maybe they're trying to, but we could do something really interesting and weird and different to make it unique, because you've got this crazy sound that I don't even know how you,
yeah,
I don't even know how you got this,
yeah,
so
yeah,
so effed, it's weird, and let's just go with that, but it's not going to sound like Steely Dan, so yeah. Just forget about that.
Steely Dan.
Yeah.
So Danny, your place is called Good Danny's.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw in the thing, I can't remember if I watched you say it or if I read you saying it, that it's not just, it's kind of like wherever you go,
I guess
Good
so,
Danny's.
Yeah.
You bring the Good Danny's
I
with
bring
you.
I guess everywhere I go, there's a Good Danny.
And you have a really comprehensive website. What's the address? I'm sorry.
It's just gooddannys.com.
Gooddannys.com. Yeah, you can see all the work Danny's worked on. You can pick up his record or call him up.
Yeah, I've got a few people. Compilation records that are, that if you want one, come and get it.
Of like your favorite production?
Yeah, I put out one every year. That's it's like my favorite stuff I've worked on that year.
And did you bring me one?
I didn't. I should have. Oh, you know what? I have one in the car. I did bring you one. I just left it in the car.
Yeah, good. Thank you.
Yeah, I put one of those out every year for have a little day party during South by Southwest and put one of those out. And it's another good way to.
Where is your party there at the studio?
No, I've done it at different places. The last couple of years, it's been at the Parish. And yeah, I always have like tons of bands I've worked with that day. It's sort of a good day to kind of celebrate everyone, you know, everyone that I've worked with. I call the compilation Good Danny's Good Friends. And
that's good.
And I think that's sort of telling of what the sort of purpose is. It's a way for me to like stop and reflect on everything I've done in the past year and sort of, you know, look at, you know, what are my favorite things and, you know, try to create something that sort of puts some kind of punctuation mark on that year's worth of work. But then it's also a way for the people that I work with to hear the other stuff I do and, you know, connect with other bands that I also work with. And, you know, I like it when the people that I am working with and like, you know, end up playing on each other's records and share bills and kind of play matchmaker a little bit. It's fun for everyone to kind of celebrate it together.
I have to say there seems to be, I mean, after like I've lived here since 1991 straight and I've been playing the whole time and I've, you know, several different incarnations and different sort of places. It feels now that there is a
friendly vibe.
Friendly vibe.
Yeah.
That sort of like 2000s indie rock,
it was a little more like
I won't go to this because why are you at Emo's? You do not belong here. You know,
yeah,
what I mean?
Right.
That, I mean, there was a lot of that. I don't want to be like that, but like people were like that, and I've never really viewed a scene as with as many divisions in it. You know, as I had seen even here,
right?
And now it seems like it's just kind of like everyone's cool again.
Yeah, good.
Each other.
Let's keep it
we're all
that
just
way.
Playing. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was cool. The other night after Slow Train was recording with you, I played They Backed Me Up
doing
a song at this Bob Dylan thing.
Right, right.
And so it's just cool. Everyone's just kind of like hanging out. We're all friends.
It's such a small world. I mean, there's so much talent around here. Why not be cool with everybody?
Yeah, why not?
I mean, you know, the thing is you never know when somebody like working with Adoniram from Slow Train, like, he's played organ. He plays organ on one of the What Made Milwaukee Famous songs. It's like there's just you work with these people and go, oh, you know what?
Who would be really perfect for
this is this guy. And it's like, why not all be cool with each other? We'll do better. Everyone will do better work and be more successful if we kind of work together to help each other's creative endeavors. You know?
Yeah, definitely. All right, Danny, you are awesome.
Thanks,
I'm glad you were able to come by.
Me too.
And I'd like to. When are you coming back from your tour with Shearwater?
Well, I'm actually here for a couple months. I'm leaving for that tour in October, and that tour actually we're opening for Dinosaur Jr. and we're actually coming back through Austin, I think on October 4th or 5th, maybe it's the first week of the tour.
Rocktober.
So Rocktober. It will definitely be Rocktober with Dinosaur Jr. It's
going to
be very loud. So I leave for that tour in October, and then home for a few days and go out on another tour in Europe for about a month. And then I'm here until, you know, we do another Shearwater record and need to go out and play it again.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I will, I'll check in with you from time to time if you don't mind. I have a portable recorder too. I can come visit
you.
Awesome.
Let's do it.
Say hey. And thank you so much. Is there anything I'm missing?
I've
GoodDannies.com. It's a great website. You got good bios. You got your whole discography on there. You can listen to a bunch of tunes you've done. And Danny Reich, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Danny Reich, man, what a cool guy. I'm really glad that he came over. I'm glad that we got to sit down and talk. I got to like get to know him. Glad he got to come over to my house and look at this. Probably thought this studio was pretty sad. Although I bet he liked my piano, which is now in tune, courtesy of John Sanchez, who I interviewed on this show as well. Anyway, Danny, thank you for coming. Be sure you go to GoodDannies.com, GoodDannies.com. Guys, awesome. He does a shitload of work, and it's all great. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, and you can follow me on Twitter at Johnny Gowdy. You can like our page on Facebook, How Did I Get Here, and drop us a line every once in a while. Let us know how we're doing. Let me know. I'd like to know. And here's some more music that Danny Reich did. This is a band called White Denim. They were on the show too. Here we go, White Denim. Thank you, Danny Reich.
Sailing in ice white, sea billowing, light at night, and then only color is as it is. Oh, it is as it is. And flight gaining bites that might cost them their lives, but it is as it is. Oh, it is as it is. Their leaves live floating in the wind, their rose wheel starting to bend, their house and its inhabitants. For what is as it is. What is and is as it is. Sounds me in the dark.